welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves, and our icebreaker question is about the security researcher who helped with stopping WannaCry, and the judge allowed him to use internet while he waits for a trial. And my question isn't about whether or not you think he's guilty, but it's interesting that the judge let him use the internet. And do you think in the future, by limiting use of the internet, will be a painful punishment for the individuals accused of a cybercrime?
This is Mike. I missed the last couple podcasts because I was out. I did not have internet. I was in a house in North Carolina, and I was forced to play Halo 3 with my 7-year-old nephew because we couldn't get online and do anything else. So yes, it feels like jail.
This is Chris. I don't know. I was thinking about it for a bit before the podcast, and I'm thinking back to life before the internet, and I remember I did okay. I think it may be a little different now that I've gotten accustomed to having constant access to it, and I've definitely been in situations where I felt kind of detached from the rest of society if I didn't have it, but I think it might be restricting in certain ways, but in other ways kind of liberating at the same time. I think my brain worked a little better when I didn't have constant distractions and constant access to all the information in the world. So it might be a positive. You never know.
And this is Jeff. I have 3 answers to this question. As far as a punishment, it is probably is going to be cruel and unusual punishment as we move forward in society. Personally, for me, it's a vacation, and it's wonderful when you cut the cord and off the grid for a couple days. It's really nice and liberating. And jail just sounds awful, and I never want to go.
Thanks, guys. And for our regular listeners, if you enjoy our show, if you can rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit Varonis.com/review. So lately, I'm curious to see what happens to IT pros, whether they're hacking for research, for fun, for profit. And we're seeing things happen in ways that we haven't had a past precedent for. And I'm going to present a few stories today for us to discuss. Some are old, some are new. And researchers, they recently figured out how to encode malware into physical strands of DNA, and such that the data becomes a program that corrupts a gene sequencing software and it takes control of the computer. And they haven't figured out how to protect DNA sequencing and processing. But can you guys explain how a buffer overflow attack works? Because I think that's what's happening with a computer that processes DNA.
When you ask for memory in an application, you say how much. If you say, hey, I'm going to be doing some stuff, I need a megabyte of memory. So you're given that section of memory to play around with. And then if you use more than that, it overflows that buffer. And so if it's done in a particular way, it can overwrite other things that are running. So a separate application that's also running in memory, other data that's around, however that happens. And, you know, a buffer overflow, it's not a specific attack, it's a category. It's like saying SQL injection or password brute forcing. So this is something that, yeah, I guess it's just a category of attack. So it's really the application that is reading in all and trying to figure out what's happening with the DNA that's then compromised.
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting set of research that we're talking about here. First, they have to encode the DNA with the actual instruction, the machine code instruction, and then it has to go through, be read by the machine, and do the buffer overrun attack on top of that. So write their instruction set into the executable code of whatever's in RAM at the time. The fact that that's even possible is amazing. And the fact that they're researching this is amazing, and it's going to have other applications down the road. We'll be able to store, and they're working on storing data on bacteria and algae and using that for storage. It's amazing stuff. But then to go forward and use that as a cyber attack is another thing that I hadn't considered about this. I found it fascinating. I'm glad somebody's thinking about it because we can start working on protecting ourselves from the DNA payloads of the future, but it's really interesting to see how this is going to happen.
This is a stunt. I mean, it's neat and it's cool, but it's not really something that we need to be concerned about, that, oh my gosh, my DNA is going to hack my iPhone. And to me, the real lesson of this is that, you know, anytime there's input, you have to work on sanitizing it. You have to work in thinking that it's an exploit. And, you know, at the base of it, this is an exploit of this fast queue file compression, which is, you know, kind of similar, like everyone works with zip files or tar files. And, you know, there's been all sorts of weird hacks and stuff with those over the years. And this is really kind of, you know, working backwards to do the same thing. So it's, while this is interesting in that they actually took the time to, you know, write this to a piece of DNA, I think a far more likely attack is that someone wants to, you know, do corporate espionage. So they make a fast queue file that's compromised and they email it to a researcher like, hey, can you take a look at this? And they're like, sure. And then all the research goes out to a competitor. I actually have one more comment about this, which is that I don't know if anyone has seen Bones, the TV show, that there was a lot of times we see these like, oh, these are crazy, like CSI. And they're like, we had to trace the IP. And then like three people get on the keyboard so they can hack faster to trace the IP faster and things. That it's these ridiculous computer things. And a long time, one of the most ridiculous things was on Bones that someone had like put a computer virus into like this artificial bone they made or something, so that when the image recognition software read it, it would corrupt them. Now, and I made fun of that for the longest time, and now I feel like I have egg on my face because of this encoded malware, that it actually came true.
So a year ago, Australia, they made it illegal to re-identify anonymized data. And they did say that white hatters will be exempt from this law. And in the UK, I think they're trying to follow suit. And there's a new data protection bill that will contain a clause and making it illegal for individuals to intentionally re-identify individuals from anonymized data. And it makes it sound like, well, if people stop re-identifying anonymized data, we'll all be better off. But there's still that problem of releasing poorly anonymized data, and they don't say anything about white hats. And what are your perspectives of re-identifying anonymous data or having poorly anonymized data? What are some key points that we should be aware of when it comes to this situation?
I really think there's a lot of intent that needs to back this up. If you go over to your neighbor's house because you see their door, you know, flapping open, and you call in like, hey, everyone okay in there? And you like look around to see if they're there, and then you close the door. Technically, you're trespassing. Technically, you entered the house without their permission. But that's very different than if I walk over with a sledgehammer and smash my neighbor's door in and take his stereo. That, to me, that's really where the difference is. And I think de-anonymizing this data, for the most part, hasn't been to exploit it. It hasn't been that, oh, I'm going to de-anonymize this and then turn around and, you know, attack someone with it. I'm going to blackmail someone. It's been, oh my gosh, you let this all out thinking it was fine and it's not fine. Please take this down. And so to me, that's really the difference. And I feel like these laws don't adequately consider that when they're being written.
I mean, they made the point that basically it's like a situation where if there's rules in place, the people who are going to be affected by this will be more the people on the research side than the people who, you know, would exploit it. If there's a law saying you shouldn't do this, and there's very clear repercussions of breaking that law, people who are on the white hat side are probably going to try and abide by it, while those who would aim to abuse that information probably won't be deterred by that in the first place. They're breaking the law anyway. They're just going to go for it. So I think if it's going to hurt the ability for us to better prepare and better research this, and obviously is a negative to it, I think it is well intended potentially, but maybe not applied properly.
This is an interesting situation for me because I don't know exactly what problem they're trying to solve. Are they trying to solve a problem where people go in and figure out who's assigned to what data?
Well, I think in the past, people like hospitals, they've taken patient data and then they would strip out their unique identifiers. Eventually, that data, people have found that it's been either released and people are able to re-identify that data point, and then somehow you won't be able to apply for a mortgage or something like that because you have an illness. I've spoken to researchers and they say it's pretty hard to re-identify data. It's like they say, if you're able to get your birth date and a zip code, it's pretty hard. It's still pretty hard to re-identify people because people are often moving a lot. But it's important, I think, to realize that our data's out there and that people are trying to buy it and try to see if they're able to profit off of it with like aligning, okay, these patients maybe have diabetes, let's sell them these wearables to help them with their glucose control or something like that. And it might be an easier target. I think that's the problem.
I really thought Jeff was going to say, I feel conflicted about this because I de-anonymize personal data. Yeah.
That's it's my a second hobby. Job.
I've been doing it since I was a kid. You know, I got into it early.
I'm not that smart at all. That's way too much time.
I think that's a huge big data problem too, right? There's so much patient data or data in general that how are we going to manage it in a responsible way? So something to think about. Next article I found is just so sensationalized, I think. So a hacker, they made it possible to install malware on an Amazon Echo, and then it would silently stream audio from the hacked device back to the hacker server. And even though people are worried about eavesdropping devices and being recorded, I thought it was illegal to record someone without their acknowledgement. And just because you can eavesdrop on someone, you have to have a lot of time to listen or re-listen to what someone else is saying. And I don't know anyone that interesting that I'm, you know, would stop my life and, you know, listen to them. And it's definitely an invasion of privacy to eavesdrop on a conversation. But how much like value would it be to listen to someone or to listen to a conversation you weren't invited to listen in on to begin with? What do you guys think?
I used to work for 3M, and 3M, you know, people make like post-it notes and stuff. But at the heart of it, they're an intellectual property generation machine that, you know, they make this stuff, and it's like the secret formula for post-it notes. And then they also, so they make everything from that up to like MRI machines to, you know, parts that could potentially be used in nuclear reactors and all this crazy stuff. So no matter what you do for them, they put you through all this training, and a lot of it's on like how not to fall victim to corporate espionage, how not to like, you know, attack other people. And like, is it okay to take a pamphlet from someone's booth at a trade show? Is it bad to hire someone to break into their hotel room at, you know, a conference and steal confidential materials? And you have to like say what you're doing in these tests that they give you. So if you could steal the secrets of 3M through an Amazon Echo, I think it would be worth it.
Sure. I mean, I think that it wouldn't even have to be something of a corporate nature. It could just be, you know, any kind of personal information. I mean, we kind of trust that we have these microphones sitting around in our homes. And I've gotten to the point where I'm not mindful at all of the conversations I'm having in front of it. You know, I could be talking about, I don't know, stuff that's happening at work. I could be talking about personal information that's of a medical nature or a financial nature, and things that you would say behind closed doors to people you trust, but wouldn't necessarily want that getting out. Now, that being said, this particular attack for me doesn't frighten me that much. When I thought about it, really, they went through the whole point of talking about this is a physical device you're attaching to an Amazon Echo that you can tell it's there. If you did make the device small enough to be not that visible, it's effectively the same as going into someone's house and placing a wiretap anyway. So it's not as if it's a new or unique or you know, some sort of new tricky thing to do that, you know, we can go and spy on people. If you're going to get into their house and have access to their Amazon Echo anyway, there's not a huge draw in that necessarily from my perspective. I think it definitely draws attention to the fact that we do have these devices that have that capability and are effectively just microphones listening to us. Obviously, you know, we can generally, from what I've seen, you know, trust them. But I do know people who will actually go and turn their Echo to off or to mute, rather, 95% of the time, because they're paranoid enough about it that they're worried that someone will have access to that information.
That's something that drives me nuts, because I see this too. I see all this like paranoia over Amazon Echoes and, you know, very intelligent people who I respect a lot, they're like, oh, I don't want an always on microphone in my house. And then they're like, let me just pull out my cell phone, which is also a GPS, a microphone, a speaker, has all my data in it and everything else that I wander around freely and has had known issues of butt dialing someone and, you know, bad things being disclosed or, you know, actual hacks. There's all sorts of weird, sketchy applications that let you, you know, track people against their will, without their knowledge, or, you know, to really wiretap them. It's a concern, like, certainly, but it's so much less than where we're actually at already, where everyone has a smartphone. I see, you know, the kids at Taco Bell on break, and they have smartphones.
To me, it gets back to corporate responsibility of data, and we've talked about this a lot around here, about making sure that the data that you have is secure and protected, doesn't get out, correctly anonymized if necessary, and doesn't have information that can be used against another human later on. It's just a problem in the 21st century that we're going to be dealing with until either data is so ubiquitous that everybody knows everything, or we've got a good set of privacy concerns and standards worldwide where everybody knows how to deal with the situations that come up just like this all the time.
I want to talk about these researchers that found a way to make cars see signs in and misidentify them. And so they placed small stickers to a stop sign and caused their vision system of the computer to misidentify it as a 45 speed limit sign. And I wanted to see what your thoughts were with some of the key takeaways from that article.
Well, this one I thought was fascinating. So, I mean, I guess it has to do with autonomous cars and their computerized vision capabilities and the ability for them to tell what a stop sign is, what a speed limit sign is, and then handle that instruction accordingly. I think this is really interesting stuff. I mean, it's a bit spooky if you think about how many times you've gone down the street and seen, like, you know, somebody slapped a sticker on a stop sign. And that's if that was to be some sort of effectively an attack vector, you know, I just put a sticker on the sign and that's it. And you could have basically break the computer or cause it to perceive there was no need to stop or that it would affect the way that it was driving just by seeing something that's obviously a concern. I did read at the bottom of the article that this is not the only way for it to tell, you know, what kind of sign it's looking at. There's obviously other fail safes put in there. And this is just one, you know, one piece of the puzzle. It's not as if that this is going to necessarily cause all autonomous cars to have this issue. And now that they've identified it, obviously we can, you know, put more fail safes in place effectively. But I think it's interesting that we're at the point now where that minor of an alteration to a sign can cause that kind of issue.
This is really interesting to me because this gets into a lot of the neural networks and machine learning that goes into images, and both that what we perceive as like easily differentiated things, the computer can think of in an entirely different way. And if you've ever seen any of the classification data, it seems to work in a very different way where, you know, there'll be a picture of a zebra and it goes, it's a zebra. And then you see a picture of, you know, something that looks nothing at all like that. And it goes, oh, that's also a zebra, you know? And it's not necessarily picking up on the same things we are. And I thought this was just fascinating that this certainly seems like there's the one example in here of where there's graffiti that says love and hate and looks kind of, you know, pixelated on top of a stop sign. It doesn't look like someone is deliberately like, you know, if I took a stop sign, spray painted it white and then stenciled 45 miles an hour on it, like, okay. Like, that's very, very obvious. But if someone puts, like, a pixelated love and hate on a stop sign that makes it, you know, to, you know, be misclassified as a 45-mile-an-hour sign, like, oh, my gosh. Like, that's going to be on an episode of Bones where someone gets murdered and, you know, Bones has to go out and scrape off the stickers. I think it's fascinating. And even makes me think that this could be an exploit in the same way we talked about the DNA exploit, where this is this unrestricted input to these systems. And, you know, like this is sort of in that same model.
Are you calling the car systems visually impaired?
Differently impaired.
So. Differently. Well, it'd be interesting where like maybe every morning before you drive, your computer system can take like a quick visual impairment test to see if you're like looking at visual images properly. That might be interesting, but take forever.
quick systems diagnostic right before you launch off.
Yeah.
I think it makes sense.
Get in your car, ask it, what's the lowest line on this chart that you can read? Just read the one.
Read the lowest one.
The stop sign, it may look blacker and smaller, but still blurry. Just tell me which one looks better.
I'm the biggest proponent I know of autonomous vehicles. I love the concept. I love the idea. I can't wait for there be no humans in charge of driving themselves from one place to another because humans are really bad at it. We have proven that throughout the past 100 years. We're no good at this job. I have concerns that this is going to be a thing, but it's probably not, because how many of these different systems are you're going to have? So you might have one car that gets through that one stop sign that's got the one piece of tape on it, but then it talks to all the other cars, and all the other cars are like, oh, there's a crazy car. Let's get out of the way. And then the stop sign says, oh, you should have stopped, and then it learns and figures it out, and we all move on with our happy little autonomous driving cars, like the little happy flock of everybody that we can have.
What if the machines start talking to each other and then they get into a fight of who needs to go first?
I don't think this is like a death knell for autonomous cars or anything. And I think it's an interesting hack, but certainly anyone can go out with a ratchet set and just take down a stop sign and cause a horrible issue right now. What's interesting about this is how subtle it is to me, and that really gets to that sort of difference in perception and difference in, like, what an interesting attack. Like, it's an attack that doesn't look like an attack.
And it's important research. I'm glad there are people out there that are figuring these problems out today. So when we do all buzz around in our little autonomous vehicles, those problems are already fixed.
We've been talking about how researchers can identify different vulnerabilities, such as this car visual stop sign problem. But let's also talk about the responsibility of finding the vulnerabilities and then responsibly notifying the security teams that are responsible. So there's a company, Direct Defense. They claim that Carbon Black had an architectural flaw leaking customer data when in fact it wasn't, and they didn't check with Carbon Black before posting their findings. And a lot of people in the security business commented on what happened, and I wanted to hear your thoughts.
I guess I wanted to kind of pull the room first. My understanding is generally you're supposed to tell the manufacturer before you go out and share that kind of information with the rest of the world. Am I incorrect on that?
There's no law about it.
More like a general, like, good practice sort of thing. Not like I'm sure that's not a law, but wouldn't that generally just be best practice?
You would think they would have opened a case and said, hey, we found this thing. What's going on? Instead, they went and broadcast it to the world.
I think that's a bit of a faux pas,
right?
Yeah, I think that was probably the bit of a misstep on their part. It's interesting because you realize this is the kind of stuff that may be done with the best of intentions, but if they're incorrect, this is the potential to, you know, affect the company's bottom line, their reputation, and I'm sure in countless other ways. So you really do have to be incredibly careful about what you're sharing and make sure you're 100% right about it before you do that.
We talk a lot about these ecosystems of technological products and things. But to me, this is a really human thing. This is something that's much more like, well, I want to be the first to share this thing so I get the credit. I want to be the first that, you know, was able to break the story about this. And I think in the rush to do that, I think mistakes can be made. So I think it's a cautionary tale to anyone doing security research. It's a great lesson in the downside and risk of trying to rush to publish things first.
It's also interesting that when you think about a closed source software versus an open source software, how the same situation comes up. When you have a closed source system, Carbon Black is definitely closed. We can't go download the code. We can't look at it ourselves to do our research directly on the code. So we assume from behavior and testing what's going on. When you have an open source system and a lot of the open source community, they will just go look at the code and they will read through the code themselves and see what it's actually doing and try to figure it out. It's one of the advantages to me for an open source system as far as security concerns are, because you have a lot more people who are looking at the same stuff, not a small group of developers that are in charge of maintaining that system in perpetuity. So that small group of developers changes over time. And that's where we talk about day one vulnerabilities and how do those get resolved, and how do future vulnerabilities get resolved? If it's closed source, it's a responsibility of a small group of people that have limited capability, versus an open source system where those things get patched so fast when they find these kind of major vulnerabilities in the systems.
Yeah, I don't know. I go back and forth with that. I think there's good ways to do both sides of that. I think the classic counterexample to what you're describing, Jeff, is the OpenSSL library, which is massive, has tons of exploits and craziness in it. And we've seen, you know, two or three major, like, shutting the internet down almost security issues that have come out of that, to where now it's entirely rewritten by a new team and different things. Mm-hmm. And that's not, I'm not trying to say those are bad people. They had almost no resources, and they were maintaining this crucial part of the internet's infrastructure, the OpenSSL folks. And in this case, I don't even know if it makes that much sense, because we're literally talking about, like, enable, disable buttons inside of their configuration, that this isn't something that's lurking in some, like, DLL that's, you know, included in the application that would only be seen by more people.
This case is definitely bad reporting, I would say, as opposed to the bigger discussion about whose responsibility is it to deal with these vulnerabilities, and how important is it for those software organizations to be responsive in an honorable and actionable way moving forward with their vulnerabilities, and how it would be different. For me, the reporting wouldn't have happened in an open source environment. They would have opened the bug, and they would have said, we found this issue, we need to get it fixed. It wouldn't be a situation where somebody would post on a blog attacking a brick-and-mortar company.
Hey, Mike, do we have a tool of the week?
Yes. We've talked a lot the last month or two and seen some fairly high-profile issues with Amazon S3, mostly just people configuring it oddly and not realizing what was happening. So Amazon has now released a new service, a security tool called Amazon MACIE, which helps with data classification and usage and working on, you know, trying to do data loss prevention inside of S3. And so this is something very familiar to all of us, because this is something that Varonis does for enterprise customers all over. So if you're using S3, it's a neat service to check out. Amazon MACIE.
Thanks to Mike Buckby, Chris Kaiser, Jeff Petters, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at @infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.